Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. My guest today is Kara Burnage, an assistant professor in the Department of Philosophy and World Religions at the University of Northern Iowa, where she specializes in the history of religion in the United States, method and theory in religious studies, and the study of religion, secularism, and empire. Professor Burnage received her doctorate at Florida State University after completing an undergraduate degree at Washburn University. She is the author of numerous articles, book chapters, and encyclopedia entries, and recently published the book, A Peaceful Conquest, Woodrow Wilson, Religion, and the New World Order, just out with the University of Chicago Press. Kara also has a really nifty article entitled Religious Influences on U.S. Foreign Policy that is available free over at Oxford University Press, which we will link to on our website. It's pretty great that presses will oftentimes allow the public free access to this stuff, so nothing better than getting educated about stuff at a low cost. We urge you to go and download that article and pick up a copy of Professor Burnage's book as well. Kara, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony. I really appreciate you extending the invitation and letting me be a part of the show today.
Yeah, it's a really neat book that came across my desk. One of the things that interests me is where scholars come up with their topics and their ideas for dissertation topics and papers and things. You're a fairly young scholar. You're an assistant professor in the profession, and not that many younger folks are interested in religion and or Woodrow Wilson nowadays. In fact, I don't know how many people knew that Woodrow Wilson was a president. So how did you go from Washburn University in Topeka, Kansas, the home of the fighting Ichabods, I should mention, to writing a book about the influence of religion on U.S. foreign policy a century ago?
Thank you for that question. Well, if you would have told me as an undergraduate that I would write a book at all, let alone a book about Woodrow Wilson, I certainly would not have believed you. Woodrow Wilson and presidents in general weren't exactly my interest as an undergraduate. I became a history major late in my undergraduate career, in part because I went to a wonderful liberal arts university that embodies the highest ideals of a liberal arts institution, go Ichabods. I was a hardworking student and I really loved school, but I didn't have any direction. And I took whatever classes interested and challenged me. And so I had a variety of experiences inside and outside the classroom. And it wasn't until I enrolled in a American religious history course with Dr. Alan Behrman, who is still at Washburn University. And he began our class with a giant statement. He said, "This class will change your life." And at the time, you know, I was an undecided student who made pretty good grades, but didn't really know what she was doing with her life. And that class really did end up changing my life. I had a great time in the class. I learned a lot. It really opened my eyes to religion in American history and the important roles that religion plays in the public sphere and in politics. At the same time, I was interning at the Kansas State Legislature, and I happened to be interning with the chair of the Education Committee the same year that the Kansas State Legislature was debating teaching creationism in biology classes or other science classes. And so I got a front row seat to these public debates where church leaders were testifying in front of the committee about why creationism needed to be taught alongside science curriculum and also why science didn't need to be taught alongside a science curriculum. And those two things at the same time in the same semester really got me thinking about how important religion is in the world and the role it can play in American public life. So that, coupled with the fact that Dr. Behrman asked me point blank, what are you going to do with the rest of your life? I started thinking about graduate school for the first time.
Before you get to graduate school, I have to ask a question because you're a history major and we're leaving Washburn University now to follow you down to Florida State.
Yeah.
But how did Washburn University, Topeka, Kansas, get a nickname Ichabods? I mean, I think Ichabod is that guy from Boston, yeah, Headless Horseman
right.
kind of stuff, right?
Yeah. So I am happy to talk about Ichabod Washburn, the namesake of Washburn University fighting Ichabods. So, because actually, it's an interesting story in and of itself. My undergraduate university actually began as Lincoln College when Abraham Lincoln donated, I believe it was $25 to the university. And so it started named after Abraham Lincoln, but quickly was running into financial troubles until a wealthy businessman and philanthropist, Ichabod Washburn from Worcester, Massachusetts, donated a larger sum of money.
That's how it's follow the money.
Yeah. Yes. And Ichabod Washburn actually gained his fortune through a barbed wire company, you know, which of course was making money out west. And he wanted to found a Congregationalist institution that would be the Yale of the Midwest. So our colors are Yale blue and white. And, you know, it was founded on similar sorts of ideals as Ivy League institutions out east. And, you know, what's interesting about that in connection to me is that there are a lot of service opportunities at Washburn. So as a history major, in addition to internships, I also was involved in community service programs at the university, and I found myself volunteering in a few after-school programs that were in neighborhoods that had a high minority population. And what I learned through my American Religious History class was that the neighborhood I was volunteering at for an after-school program was actually the former neighborhood of Tennessee Town, which Congregationalist minister Charles Sheldon, who wrote the famous book, In His Steps, What Would Jesus Do?, where he served as a pastor during the height of the social gospel movement. And so through my experiences at Washburn, through my American Religious History class, I was learning how to put myself and my life in a larger historical context. And that was really, really fascinating.
Well, that leads you down then to Florida State University. It seems like you're pump primed to be studying this topic now.
Exactly. And I was very interested in the social gospel movement. Well, still am interested in the social gospel movement. But that's how I got my start. I did an undergraduate thesis, full thesis, big research component as the capstone of the undergraduate experience in the major, and I studied women's temperance movements in Kansas and learned about female religious leaders because that's where my passion was. And my historical hero at the time, and probably she still is, was Alice Paul, the Quaker suffragist, who led the National Women's Party, protested outside of Woodrow Wilson's White House during the Great War. I admired her so much as an undergraduate. And so my first connection to Wilson actually began with him as the villain to my Shiro in American history. So I really didn't think much about Woodrow Wilson going into graduate school. I was accepted to Florida State for master's and PhD program, which was another fantastic experience. Florida State has a really special program on its hands because it has a large cohort. It has several faculty who are studying American religious history. So Amanda Porterfield, John Corrigan, Amy Kohlinger was there when I began. And this large cohort really takes care of each other. So it was a graduate environment of the best kind because we took intense classes together. We're writing all these papers. We're also teaching through our assistantships. But everyone there, while I was there, really got along and helped each other out. So it felt a lot like my liberal arts institution experience. And everyone that I was in contact with, we were pretty experimental, too, in part because our advisors were. They encouraged us to try new things, to take risks, to follow hunches, and to really think in big ways about narrating American religious history. And so through Amy Kohlinger's 20th century class, we started thinking about the relationship between American religious history and what we might call, you know, American history proper, the standard survey narrative. And what we began to realize together as a class was that what ends up being lost in American religious history classes is the role of the state. That the standard conventional political narrative sometimes falls to the background when we're telling the story of religious lives in America. And that was really compelling to me. And so based on my interests, I started thinking about dissertation topics, and I still wanted to study the social gospel. I wanted to continue with many of the actors on the ground in these local communities that I was interested in, but I wanted to tell a story of its power in a more conventional sense with the state. And so I had begun to be interested in foreign policy and the role of America in the world. And so my dissertation advisor, Amanda Porterfield, talked to me about, you know, ways that we might think about these connections for in the archive or in secondary sources. And she just asked me point blank. She's like, well, have you thought about Woodrow Wilson? And I said, no, I hadn't thought about him at all.
Yeah, not many people have, yeah.
Right. And so what ended up happening from there, she's like, well, why don't you take a couple weeks and think about him a little bit? And so I went to the, you know, the university library, and because Woodrow Wilson's a president, his presidential papers are available at most university libraries, and so FSU had the 69-volume set edited by Arthur Link. And I dove in first thinking I was going to look for connections between the social gospel figures that I was familiar with, like Walter Rauschenbusch, Charles Sheldon, Washington Gladden, George Herron. But as I started to read through his papers and read his speeches, these connections are just leaping off the page to me about the way that the social gospel movement specifically, or liberal Protestantism more generally, was in his rhetoric. And I just couldn't avoid it. And so I started checking out some of the secondary literature, the recent biographies on Woodrow Wilson, and what I was finding in these award-winning books that were really fantastic works of history was that they tended to talk about Woodrow Wilson's religion in very specific ways, as being formative to him as a young man, as developing a sense of conviction in him that shaped him during president, and ultimately as a major contradiction with his lofty rhetoric of the equality of all nations and self-determination. And as I read that, I couldn't agree. I disagreed very strongly about the way that the secondary literature was talking about Woodrow Wilson's religion. And then I, you know, began conversations again with Amanda Porterfield, that there's something here that I think I can offer a different way of viewing Woodrow Wilson and the ministers and the movements that are shaping his thinking that I think other historians can't. And so we went with it as a dissertation topic.
Very cool. So let's you've dug into Woodrow Wilson here quite a bit. For the folks who are not all that familiar with the president right there at the turn of the century, just a few, about a decade after the turn of the century, give us some background about who Woodrow Wilson was, specifically his religious and intellectual upbringing, which you've already foreshadowed a bit.
Yes, so Woodrow Wilson is a president who lived during a fascinating and transitional time in American history. So his life spans from just before the Civil War to what we'd call the interwar period. And that shaped him in fascinating ways. So one of his earliest memories as a boy was a man coming to his home to let his father know that Abraham Lincoln had just won the election. And so he's a boy of the Civil War, a young man of Reconstruction. He ends up getting his education at Princeton University, which he later becomes president of the university, and then begins a life of public office, being the governor of New Jersey. And then after being governor of New Jersey, he runs for president in 1912. And he's president of the United States for two terms, which takes him and the United States through World War I. What he's most known for, though, is his role in foreign policy, which is somewhat ironic because he had very little experience in foreign policy prior to coming to office. But today, his legacy, as it's talked about most often, is his vision for a liberal international world, by which we tend to mean an international society that is based on collective security. So nations coming together to agree to, in his time, to not expand a nation's empire through conquest or territorial acquisition, for nations to collectively agree to protect one another, to protect smaller nations or developing nations, to base their interactions on free trade, open seas, and collective work for the greater good of all of the world as much as possible. For many, this vision that he outlines was idealist and moralist, and that's where I come in through this book, to try to think of new ways of understanding how this vision came to be and its long-term legacy.
You know, Woodrow Wilson's, it's an interesting pivot point in American history because it was not surprising that he wasn't thinking about foreign policy because the U.S. was, you know, a minor player in world affairs in the late 1800s into the early 1900s, and it really moves to the center stage around World War I and afterwards. And so he gets an important role in influencing and shaping this, as you just mentioned. And a lot of this, as your book points out, comes from his own personal religious background, which is Presbyterian and also influenced by some of the social gospel movement. So talk a little bit about that formative religious background of Wilson.
Sure. One of the things that really fascinated me about Woodrow Wilson early on in my research was the way that American religious life is changing in very substantial ways over the course of his lifetime. So the secondary literature right now primarily concentrates on the role of Woodrow Wilson's father, which was a very, very influential role. So Woodrow Wilson was born to a Southern Presbyterian family. So they were strong Calvinists. They believed that God had designed an order to the world, and in the home of his childhood, that order to the world included strict places for people in society based on gender roles. So the role of his father as a patriarch of the home, as modeling Christian male leadership to both him as his son, but also to his mother and his sisters and to the entire community. His mother, as a complement to her husband, would raise the children, teach her children their catechism through the Presbyterian Church, and to cultivate within them as much as possible the desire to live a Christian life, a moral life, and a life that sought to follow God's will for them. And Wilson's parents modeled this in a variety of ways, through first and foremost his education. So his father educated him and encouraged a broad understanding of the world. So he was exposed to the latest trends in scientific method and theory, as well as theology, elocution, oration. And alongside all of those studies, Woodrow Wilson was also encouraged by his parents to play, to have leisure time, to balance both hard work and education with fun. And that was typical of a Southern Presbyterian and generally Calvinist home of the period. So in addition to those gender roles, what Wilson learned in his home was also that God designed a separation of the races. And in particular, Wilson's father taught him and gave sermons in his church about the biblical nature of slavery. That slavery in America affirmed God's design for the world and affirmed God's will for the world. And by maintaining slavery in the United States, Americans would uphold God's order for society. So as I see it very early on, Wilson's Christianity is teaching him about a specific way of understanding world order and of understanding the place of people in society. But that changes in very dramatic ways in American history, because just before his fourth birthday, Abraham Lincoln wins the 1860 election, and soon after that, America is at war. The Civil War begins, and Woodrow Wilson's family supports the Confederacy in Augusta, Georgia. As they move from place to place, wherever they are, his family is supporting Confederate troops. His mom briefly serves as a nurse for wounded soldiers. The church that his dad is serving also serves as a hospital. Sometimes the courtyard serves as a jail for Union soldiers. And so they're very invested in ensuring a Christian order to the world, so far as they're willing to support acts of violence to make sure that the world as they understand it is upheld in American life. But of course, the South does not win the war, and Reconstruction begins, and this dramatically shapes Wilson as well. In fact, as a young man, he vows never to be a Republican as a result of Reconstruction. He says within his diary that he will always be a Democrat because of the way that Reconstruction unfolded and the role of Republicans in making Reconstruction unfold in that way. So in Wilson's mind as a young man, particularly as a college student, he sees himself as following in the footsteps of his father, and that's generally how he's written about. But what I see is a very different Christian life between Woodrow Wilson and his father, Joseph Wilson. And that's because American life is radically different. Woodrow Wilson, as a college student, understands that slavery was wrong. And he does not share the same view as his father did, that slavery was biblical. And that makes for a very different Christianity in my eyes, and I imagine in the eyes of a lot of people, that I think is worth really exploring, which is what I do in the book. And so because of Reconstruction, because of the changes to American Christianity as a result of the Civil War, what I see is Wilson doing during his college years is really rethinking his Christianity and trying as much as possible to remain true to the traditions his parents taught him, because he did value them very much. But his Presbyterianism is very different from his parents' Presbyterianism as a result. And that's where I see the social gospel movement coming in, that he, as a college student, writes about Christianity from a position that Christians need to make the world a more perfect place, that Christians must live out their Christian life in every area of their life. So in the workplace in particular, he writes about, which was a common theme among social gospel novels and social gospel ministers at the time, that Christianity didn't just occur in the church, but it occurred in the workplace and in the home. And that's where I see him shifting a great deal, the importance he puts on work life. Is a different kind of Christianity than his parents.
Now, he is being formed here at the beginning periods of this new social gospel movement, and it really starts to take off in the latter decades of the 19th century and early 20th century. So give us a sense of what that movement is talking about and how that influences him. And does that have any impact on how he runs Princeton?
So the social gospel movement is a movement within American Christianity that focuses on the gospel message as applying to both individuals and society. So just as individuals can sin, can confess, and be saved, and salvation assures certain rewards for them as an individual, so too can society as a whole sin and be saved and reap the rewards of salvation. So thinking about Christianity in this way shifts a few things for social gospel Christians. It means that social gospel Christians are willing to acknowledge that troubles within society, what we might call social ills, as they did, like alcoholism, extreme poverty, prostitution, all sorts of big social issues, were not the result of individual sin and bad choices, but were actually structural problems that pointed to sins in American life as a whole. So for some social gospelers, slavery counted as this kind of social sin. And they, as a result, turn to implementing what I refer to as state-based reform. So social gospel ministers, particularly white, middle and upper middle class, educated Christians, begin to turn to their local, state, and federal government to change legislation and laws and create all sorts of state-based means of addressing these larger social issues. And that's a very different tactic than previous Christians who might not be understanding sin and salvation as operating at both a social and individual level. For many American Christians at this time, and today for that matter, they would see social issues as operating primarily on an individual level, that the individual needed to address problems within themselves or their lives, and that the best method of addressing these problems occurred outside of the state, outside of the government, and inside churches and other non-government entities. So Wilson being shaped by this message, I think, matters a great deal because it directly affects him as a civil servant. That if a civil servant sees their job as implementing Christian reform, that changes the way I think we should understand that particular politician or civil servant. Before he has a chance to implement any of his progressive policies within the federal government, he's first at Princeton. And at Princeton, as president, one of his most famous speeches that he gave was called In the Nation's Service. And Wilson understood the role of an educated citizenry, particularly white, male, educated citizens, as being leaders of the United States. That it's these leaders, you know, similar to patriarchs like his father and him, once he and his wife have their daughters, they are to lead by example. And through their education, they've cultivated not only a broad knowledge base, but also a good moral character that allows them to see their role as needing to take care of the least among them. And this was a common social gospel impetus, to care for the least among you. But what I see as somewhat consistent in Wilson's thought is this understanding of social order. That while he's teaching young men at Princeton to care for the least among them, he's reinforcing many of these social boundaries and borders that are causing the social problems at play that need social answers.
He then moves into the role of governor of New Jersey, and how does this all play out? And then take us through the, you know, how all of this is shaping him through the presidential election of 1912.
So Wilson, through several reforms he attempts to implement in Princeton, how should we put this, does not gain the favor of the faculty as a whole at Princeton.
Yeah, university presidents never do.
No, shared governance is and was a complicated matter for everyone who's a part of it. And Wilson attempts to implement at the time, a pretty radical vision for residence halls. He wanted to create a quad-based system to try to mix different groups of students with each other, particularly different classes, socioeconomic classes, that is, and And this is met with intense resistance, you know, particularly from students who are the legacies of big named families related to Princeton. And so he quickly receives resistance from faculty, from donors, from the Princeton community as a whole. So he ends up leaving Princeton and, you know, and for a period is very lost, lost in so many different senses. You know, he's not a leader in the community anymore. He isn't currently working on any project either as a scholar. And in terms of his home life, he is pretty adrift as well, since he's not actively contributing financially to his family. So he turns to civil service and runs to be the governor of the state of New Jersey. He wins, and it's through that experience he gains some political experience, but he also gains the attention within the Democratic Party. He was by no means a big name at all. But he did begin to garner some attention for his progressive policies that in 1910 he is following the trend of the progressive movement, particularly in his interest in tax reform, his interest in taking care of social problems and trying to address poverty and these intense divisions among socioeconomic classes. So the 1912 presidential election comes around. He and his wife talk about him, you know, throwing his hat in the ring. And he does. And the Democratic Party at the time was very divided in terms of leadership, and through a few complicated matters of bigger name Democrats within the party not gaining enough votes, Wilson suddenly emerges in 1912 as a national leader through the divisions within the Democratic Party. And it wasn't unusual for the Democratic Party to have several people vying for leadership, just like it wasn't all that unusual for the Republican Party to be running into these problems as well. So famously, as a part of the 1912 election, Teddy Roosevelt leaves the Republican Party and starts the Progressive Party. So the 1912 election is very fascinating and weird and interesting, because we end up having four candidates running for office, two of whom have been president before, Teddy Roosevelt and William Howard Taft. Taft representing Republicans, Roosevelt representing the new Progressive Party, and we have Eugene Debs representing the Socialist Party, and then this sort of no-name, Woodrow Wilson, representing the Democratic Party. And one of the things that I think is really important about this election is that all four candidates use Christian rhetoric to gain their supporters and to try to pull supporters from the other parties. So even Eugene Debs, as a socialist, in his speeches is using Christian metaphors to bring people to the socialist cause. And Woodrow Wilson sort of stands apart from these other figures in terms of his Christian life, because he's been connected to the Presbyterian Church his entire life. He seems very conventional when it comes to his Christianity. The New York Times writes in tongue-in-cheek that he's predestined to win, and they fill the column with all these puns about Calvinism and Presbyterianism, because he seems a little rigid in his religious life. Very different from, say, Teddy Roosevelt, whose campaign speeches and events reporters are writing about as revival experiences, where he's giving speeches about Armageddon and there are huge prayer circles at the entire campaign event where everyone there is singing His Truth is Marching On about Teddy Roosevelt. So Woodrow Wilson emerges as this really interesting Christian statesman within the 1912 election. And he represents a certain kind of Christianity that isn't overly emotional or revivalistic and is traditional, yet is standing upon these very progressive policies that point towards big changes in American culture and American politics. And this, I think, helps him win the election. And it serves as a standard through what would become two terms in office.
Give us a sense of what is going on politically at this time. As I mentioned before, the U.S. is somewhat at a pivot point here, and the issues of foreign policy are probably not really big in 1912, even though they're about to explode on the surface here in a little bit in World War One, or was it the case that, you know, people are starting to think about America's role in the world writ large now?
So, in 1912, foreign policy was not the front runner in terms of issues that any of the candidates talked about. It primarily was domestic policy. The United States is sitting at a clear pivot point in terms of the relationship between citizens and the federal government. So there's growing interest in state-based reform and in what we would refer to now as growing the government. So there was, across candidates, an interest in increasing the size of the federal government and the scope of what local, state, and federal entities concentrated on. In particular, Americans were more and more concerned about the general welfare of the people. In 1912, standard government programs that we would think of today were not a part of the federal government or state and local government. So, for instance, in 1912, it was not common or precedented in any way for cities to take care of sanitation issues. Sanitation, like trash pickup, having access to running water, clean water for that matter, was not a responsibility of the government. If it happened at all, it was a matter of private corporations taking care of these sanitation issues, which typically meant that they didn't happen at all. In big cities, large skyscrapers are being built, but there were no standard codes that had to be met for buildings, for creating new buildings, for repairing old buildings. And this meant that many Americans were living in terrible conditions, particularly immigrants and people of color, that they were living in neighborhoods that had substandard housing and sanitation issues going on all around them. And so Woodrow Wilson, as well as Teddy Roosevelt and many other progressives, were interested in increasing regulations on corporations to ensure a standard of welfare across U.S. citizenry, and also creating government programs to look out for American citizens. and to try to address these extreme differences between socioeconomic classes. So one of the main issues for Woodrow Wilson in 1912 is his first major policy change that occurs in March after he began the presidency in 1913 was tax reform. And through tax reform, he did a variety of things. He changed tariffs. He also instituted graduated progressive income tax, created the Fed, did a number of things that we would think of as common today in terms of our economic life. But when they passed and when they were implemented, Woodrow Wilson stands in the Oval Office with reporters and with administration insiders, and as he signs legislation to change the income tax in America, he turns to everyone there and says that he's done God's work. He immediately connects what he's done as president to the will of God and to him as a servant of God by serving the American people. And that, I think, is really important to keep in mind and to think about with Woodrow Wilson as a president. Not necessarily as someone to revere and admire for this act, but as a notable connection between his politics and his religion, that for him, they're one and the same. To pass legislation, to make new laws that'll change the lives of American citizens, he's seen as his Christian duty.
So this emphasis on domestic politics, which he begins his presidency with, is going to be turned around as international affairs affect the Europe and then also the United States. The looming war, World War One, or at the time they didn't know it was the first one. They thought it as the Great War, the war to end all wars. How does this all play out in terms of Wilson's thinking, the debates of the time, and filtered through that social gospel vision that he has been cultivating over the past few decades?
Right as the Great War is beginning in Europe, Woodrow Wilson actually isn't paying attention to it at all. In August 1914, we have the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand and his wife, and European nations are, over the course of the next couple months, succumbing to war based on treaties between nations. So while we could think, that all eyes of the world were on Europe in this moment, what I found really surprising and heartbreaking, actually, was that Woodrow Wilson wasn't paying attention to it at all in August 1914. Because at the time that the Great War is breaking out, Woodrow Wilson's wife was actually dying. And his attention is totally and completely on her and his family. So in August 1914, his wife, Ellen, is slowly dying from what historians suggest is Bright's disease, and this overwhelms President Wilson. He tells his closest aides and confidants that his heart is not in his job, and that actually he's not fit for president. He is in deep, deep grief at one of the most pivotal moments in world history. But I think this has some important consequences for Wilson as president. in part, it means that he turns his attention, or at first attempts to turn his attention, to his job, because he wants to avoid his grief, and he wants to concentrate on something other than mourning. Now, at the same time, while Wilson is experiencing this devastating loss, social gospelers in the U.S. are very connected to what's happening in the rest of the world. And that's in part because prior to the Great War, actually since the turn of the century, these social gospel Christians and liberal Protestants more generally had been working with international counterparts to begin thinking about creating international Christian organizations and ways of preventing colonialism's expansion around the world. So many social gospelers were anti-colonial, or were interested in establishing some sort of international Christian body to prevent war, to prevent large-scale poverty around the world, to encourage humanitarian aid. So for many American Christians, they were already connected to their European brethren in some way. So when the Great War breaks out, they feel very invested in what's happening, even though the fight won't come to America directly at all. So many of these social gospel ministers are concerned about the war, are following it very closely, and are beginning to write about the war as a part of these large-scale Christian reform efforts that they're interested in. So, for example, Washington Gladden, who's often regarded as the father of the social gospel movement, he writes about the possibility of this war waking up people, both American Christians, but also Christians from around the world, waking them up to the truth of the gospel message as he understands it, that it applies to both individuals and society, and that the war could lead people to understand the gospel in this new and truer, as he saw it, way. And he ends up comparing it to past wars, like the 30 Years' War. He says that war in and of itself isn't necessarily against Christian advancement through missionary work or through legislation like what Wilson is doing. And paying attention to what these ministers are thinking, I think, really matters, because it calls us to challenge some of the persistent assumptions about Christians during the Great War, that Christians, true Christians, were against war completely. But what I found by reading these ministers' sermons and their notes and their books and their letters to each other is that, in fact, they quite often believed that this war, like specific past wars, could advance their Christian cause, that the war in and of itself didn't necessarily lead them to believe that violence or the use of violence was wrong in all circumstances. And that idea connects very strongly to Wilson, because Wilson, too, didn't have a principled stance on all wars. And this we can connect to his childhood, that as a child of the Civil War and Reconstruction, he understood very intimately that sometimes Christians support war if it means a greater Christian advancement. You know, his family, particularly his father, believed that the Civil War was a part of that effort. And so as I read Wilson, it wasn't difficult for him to think of the Great War as possibly leading to greater Christian ends if, which he regularly said, if Americans pay attention and do the right thing during the war.
And what would this greater end look like? I can start to see him rethinking about, you know, his role in the presidency, his and America's role in the world. How does this lead us through the war and then to one of his great initiatives, the League of Nations?
Mm-hmm. So from 1914 forward, Wilson is interested in American leadership in the world and doing what he can to ensure that the United States will be a major player in brokering peace at the end of the war. So initially, he encourages neutrality, that the United States needs to stay removed from this great war in Europe, that it was Europe's war and the United States needed to stay removed from it because, as he thought, that would put America in a position of leadership because the United States would remain disinterested through the entire conflict. And by being disinterested, the United States could take a leadership role in establishing whatever international order occurs at the end. Now, his position over the course of the war in terms of strategy changes. The United States does eventually get involved in the conflict in 1917. But as I see it, his principle and his aims remain the same, even though the means change. That from 1914 through the end of the war in 1919, he stays alert to how the United States is positioned with respect to European nations that are involved in the conflict. And from the very beginning, his primary interest is establishing an international organization of nations that can prevent future conflict, the war to end all wars. At the end, there will be an international body that can, through its existence and its moral leadership, ensure that nothing on this scale occurs again. Now, he wasn't totally unique in this desire. Many Americans across all sorts of different groups and societies, from Andrew Carnegie to William Howard Taft to social gospelers, were interested in a League of Nations at the turn of the 20th century. So William Howard Taft is president of the League to Enforce Peace, which, despite its sort of paradoxical name, was interested in creating a sort of League of Nations to prevent future conflict. Andrew Carnegie, at the same time, was also interested in creating an international body. And this was a very popular idea among Americans at the time. And so Woodrow Wilson is not unique in pushing it. He's actually reflecting and representing the will of most American citizens and thinking of this idea, but his particular vision for a League of Nations comes into its own and departs from other popular ways of thinking about a League of Nations, and it comes to be understood as Wilsonian internationalism. It gets its own name in the end by historians and political scientists, and that's because of the particular ways that Wilson envisions an international society, and based on his own scholarly interests, the way he understands the way nations work. So Wilsonian internationalism, the way that Wilson understood the League of Nations, was primarily as a structure for international society and moral aims for international society. So through his 14-point speech, for example, he outlined certain policies that he expects of international society at the end of the war. And these include things like free trade, open seas, that nations, when they enter into treaties with one another, those treaties should be open to the public. They should be transparent for the world to see and not occur in secret. And he thinks that by nations entering into a collective agreement with one another, that this can end and prevent future wars, because all nations would be agreeing to look out for the common good. And that agreement, in and of itself, he considered to be morally binding, that an international court, some sort of international military force were not needed, that the agreement in and of itself would be followed because the whole world was watching. And this is one aspect where Wilson is widely regarded as being naive as a diplomat and international statesman. But I think this resonates with his Christianity, that, you know, as other historians have written, he was a Presbyterian. He believed very strongly in covenants. And so it wasn't by accident that he called the document that creates the League of Nations the Covenant of the League of Nations. That he's not just thinking of these agreements as, you know, as a document that has ink on a page, but he was thinking of them as morally and even spiritually binding as a covenant in terms of Christian history. And that he, as I write, understood it as a culmination of Christian history, that through this League of Nations, a Christian order to the world would be implemented, and it would create an entirely new era of world history that human history had not ever seen before.
And that didn't quite turn out that way, the way at least he envisioned it. The League of Nations, as we know, somewhat falters. It finds its revival in circuitous ways in the United Nations that we have today. In terms of Wilson's legacy, when does Woodrow Wilson die?
1924.
Right. So he still doesn't see any kind of looming problems on the horizon in Europe. He's still kind of, you know, the aftermath of World War One, and things are a little shaky in Europe and that, but he could still perhaps go to his resting place thinking that mission accomplished. But in terms of Wilson's legacy, the League of Nations fails, essentially, but does he have any broader-based long-term impact on the way that U.S. foreign policy is undertaken?
I think so, absolutely. I think we are still wrestling with the legacy of Wilson's liberal internationalism. And I think the problems within Wilson's vision are still problems that we wrestle with today. So central to Wilson's League of Nations was the idea of the self-determination of all nations, that the people on the ground should consent to their government, should decide what kind of nation they have. That was a central feature, and that's what gained the attention of anti-colonial movements around the world in a great book called The Wilsonian Moment, for example. It talks about how anti-colonial movements really latch on to this idea of self-determination for good reason, because it gives anti-colonial movements a way of establishing themselves in international society. The other phrase that he's really known for is the equality of all nations, that he insists that if this League of Nations is going to work, all nations must be equal. And this, I think, is where we see the intersection of his ideological and intellectual history and how he's unique in American history yet has reverberations well beyond it. Because for Wilson, the equality of all nations didn't mean what it probably means to you and I, which is that every nation that's a part of the League of Nations has equal standing, equal voting power, equal rights, you know, fits into international society in the same way. But what I argue is that that wasn't so for Woodrow Wilson, that based on his formative years in the South, in the Southern Presbyterian Church, and his understanding of Christianity, people and nations have inherent rights, but have fundamental, inherent inequalities within society, that everyone doesn't fit in society in the same way by God's design. So just as he taught young men at Princeton, I think, and argue, he's thinking for the rest of the world and for nations within that world, that the great care for the least among them. That great nations, like the United States, have a Christian duty, a moral obligation to care for nations that are the least among them. Now, while that calling sounds like it'll work well and that it is ambitious and that it is, you know, praiseworthy, what I see as an important aspect of that calling for people and nations is the reinforcement of social difference. Social difference that for Wilson is a part of God's design based on gender and race and socioeconomic status. So his vision for the League of Nations, while it spoke to an equality of nations, it didn't actually create equality as most of us would think of it, that it reinforces fundamental inequalities. And that, I think, is something that we're still wrestling with today, that, for example, while the United States can still talk about the equality of all nations, the importance of all nations working together towards collective security, we still see instances in American foreign policy where some nations are great and others are lesser, where some nations are able to develop their own national identity, and while other nations are in need of American oversight and care because American foreign policy does not understand the people of that nation as able to establish their own nationhood without oversight and on their own. So I see these legacies as still acting in American foreign policy, and I also see the divisions within American Christianity that Wilson in part created, I think, through his foreign policy. I still see that acting today, where American Christians are deeply divided over what the role of the United States is in the world. That for Wilson and for his Christian supporters, the United States had to be engaged in the world, had to be actively involved in trying to make the world a better place as a result of their interpretation of the New Testament and of gospel message of following in Jesus' steps. But for other American Christians, particularly for more conservative American Christians, for fundamentalists who are emerging from 1912 forward, America is to be an example in the world by being removed from international society, by Christians being more removed from American mainstream culture, that American Christians are deeply divided over what the proper role of Christians in the world is. Is it actively engaged in culture, or is it removed from culture? You know, I don't think this is a new Christian question by any means, but I think in American history, Woodrow Wilson provides a poignant example of it and a flashpoint for American Christians and for global Christianity, because he has this very public forum through the Paris Peace Conference where he's attempting to implement his Christian vision, and it ends up dividing American Christians and global Christianity, I would even argue, as a result.
You give us a lot to think about in this vision of Wilt that Wilson had and your history of it, which is a really, really interesting read of it. And I encourage people to pick up your book, A Peaceful Conquest, Woodrow Wilson, Religion and the New World Order. We'll link to it on our website. I want to finish off with one final question, because you gave us so much to think about. I'm curious about how your thinking changed over the course of doing your graduate studies on this project and in the process of writing a book, because a book is always a journey and you learn things along the journey. Was there anything that surprised you or changed the way that you look at the world?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's, you know, changed most dramatically is that I had to understand the world, or attempt to understand the world, through Woodrow Wilson's eyes. That he absolutely, you know, as I said before, was the villain to my Shiro, Alice Paul. And he became, you know, over the course of my graduate career, I wouldn't have expected to get inside the head of a figure like Wilson, you know, someone who was pro-segregation, whose family was pro-Confederacy. I wouldn't have expected to spend so much time trying to see the world through his eyes. And now what's so odd to me is that I can't not see the way that he would see it now. And I think this is a really important time, though, to do that. I've, you know, as I explain it to my students now, and as I try to train other historians of religion, I think that there is something very important that I've learned myself about, first, showing historical empathy, that before we apply our critical thinking lens to whatever it is that we're studying, that I think it is important first and foremost to be able to see the world as our historical subjects see the world, and challenge ourselves to be able to articulate as closely as we can how they might see it, especially if we don't see it the same way. But that there is something to that exercise that's really valuable and really important beyond writing a book, beyond graduate school, but in life more generally, to put in our own words as much as possible the way someone else might see the world, and then step back and put it in a larger historical context.
Very good words of wisdom there. Something that we try to do by focusing on a number of historical topics, and historical topics are always one of my favorite podcasts to do here, and you've done a wonderful job explaining this interesting person and interesting era. My guest today has been Kara Burnage. Professor Burnage, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.